Thank you very much, Robin, and to the speakers. It's my pleasure to introduce Paul Leroux, who is the director of our occupational health program at McGill, who will introduce our next speaker.
Thank you, Gilles. I'll only be here for 2 minutes. So in 1 minute, I will say a few words about the occupational health program. And in the second minute, I will introduce the speaker, Dr. Howard Yu, who will talk about the recent advances in occupational and environmental health research. So as probably many of you know, the occupational health program at McGill in the Department of Epidemiology, Biostatistics, and Occupational Health is about to get a new skin following the report of Paul Demers. And so we're very excited to see how this will evolve in cooperation with our director, Gilles Paradis. So occupational health deals with a wide variety of problems, some of which are, so to speak, a little bit in the past. Think of asbestos, for example. Others are incremental problems that we are dealing with. We've had in the past a love affair with shiny bumpers on our cars, so we are still dealing with issues like chromium 6. And then there are the issues that are more jarring, what people would call unfortunate truths, for example. Things in relation to occupational health that would challenge paradigms, the illusion that we are safe while in fact we are not. So these things are a lot of fun because we have challenges against new ideas from various levels of society. So it's my pleasure today to introduce Dr. Howard Yu, who is Dean and Professor of Environmental Health, Epidemiology, and Global Health at the Dalla Lana School of Public Health at the University of Toronto. Dr. Yu came to the University of Toronto as the Dalla Lana School of Public Health's second permanent director and Professor of Environmental Health, Epidemiology, and Global Health, which is quite a package, and Professor of Medicine in the Faculty of Medicine in July 2012. On July 1st, 2013, after leading the Dalla Lana School of Public Health through the process of becoming the first new faculty at U of T in 15 years, he became the school's inaugural dean. Dr. Yu is a physician scientist trained as an internist, occupational an environmental medicine specialist and epidemiologist. Previously, he had been professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Channing Laboratory of the Brigham Women Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, and the National Science Foundation International Chair of the Department of Environmental Health Sciences and Professor of Environmental Health, Epidemiology, and Internal Medicine at the University of Michigan from 2006 to 2012. Dr. Hugh.
Thank you. It's very daunting to be the talk between you and your lunch, so I'll try to keep this on time. I have had the pleasure of learning not only about the department, but also participating in the morning's discussion about the schools of public health and the future of public health. But this is my grounding. It's in environmental health. It is my passion. This is my entire career on one slide. But the most important part of this slide is actually this piece right here. Let's see if this is... okay. It's this picture in the middle here. And for the students in the room, this is a story that you might find familiar, but only because everybody has a story on how they got interested in environmental health. In 1974, I was a freshman in college, and I was saving up for a stereo. Now, back then, we didn't have iPods. You had to buy this big clunky stereo and it cost lots of money. So I got the highest paying job I could possibly get, which was a torch burner in a shipyard. You probably know the punchline. But it was a salvaging yard and I spent the entire summer ripping asbestos off of pipes and boilers. But 5 years later, I was in medical school, and I got a letter from Irving Selikoff, a name that I hope most of you know. And he invited me for a chest x-ray and lung function test at Mount Sinai School of Medicine because I'd been exposed to asbestos. And when I sat there on the exam table and Susan Down, his associate, was interviewing me, and she said, you know, you're a medical student, and I can see you're interested in advocacy. I thought you'd be interested to know that the company physician figured out that asbestos caused lung cancer in 1937, and then the company chose to suppress that information for the next 35 years. And that's when I said, boy, this is a really interesting field. And that's how I got into occupational health. It's really about social justice. It's about policy. It's about law. It's about environmental health. It's about toxicology, about all sorts of different things. That's my story. Just a little bit of introduction to our school of public health. Ours started some time ago by James Fitzgerald. And at the time, our strength was public health nursing, environmental health, vaccine, science, and development. But there's plenty to worry about in terms of the occupational health scene in Toronto at the time. But the school has had an up-and-down history, which I talked about a little bit this morning. And today, the school does have a very important occupational health program, a large industrial hygiene training program. But most of what we do in occupational and environmental health is focused on environmental health these days. That's partly related to the transformation of our economy and sector to more of a knowledge economy. Of course, that's what's happening here in Quebec as well. But it's partly because some of the biggest issues in this field relate to global issues, globalized risks, and understanding what the footprint of environmental health is on the common diseases we experience every day. And that's where I'm going to go today. The recent advances will have some personal snapshots in some of the these interesting areas that that I've had in my own career. It's certainly not going to touch on all the big issues and advances that there are in this field that some of you also are advancing in your own work. Mostly, I'm going to go over some of the issues that use molecular epidemiology to understand this footprint of occupational and environmental risk factors on health, but then touch on some of the big macro issues before we send you off for a very good lunch. Now, I guess part of my message is that having trained as an internist and spent quite a few years just treating patients in our general medicine clinic, is that there's continued uncertainty as to what the true footprint is of environmental factors on the diseases that we worry about. And perhaps some of the most illuminating research that's been happening over the last 15 or 20 years are these twin studies. Because these large banks of twins that have now been developed in Scandinavia, some in the U.S. and elsewhere, basically pose both the clinical and the mathematical configuration, whereas simply the question is put, look, if you have an identical twin, brother or sister, and you develop Parkinson's disease, and the disease is genetic, what do you think the probability is going to be of your exact twin brother having Parkinson's disease? Well, the answer is 100%, right? And probably at the same time. But the true concordance of Parkinson's in your sibling is closer to 20% or less. And that automatically raises issues about why. And some of it is probably a little bit of random variation, but a lot of it is unaccounted for environmental risk factors. And until Carol Tanner published that study in JAMA in the mid-1990s, no one was asking the question about environment have anything to do with Parkinson's disease. But it's a big question. And 15 years later, although we've had quite a bit of research in this area, some of it sponsored by NIH, and our group has done some of this area, we have a few of the answers, but it's still a big challenge. And here's some of the examples of these twin studies. This is the one that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine from the Scandinavian twin studies. you can now use precise, statistical methods to take these statistics on concordance of dizygotic and monozygotic twins getting various diseases. And here's an example of breast cancer where the inheritance has been estimated now at 27%, with the shared environmental factors shared between the two twins accounting for 6%, but the unshared environment accounting for 67%. What really is that 67%? A big mystery that all of us can contribute to. And if we look at the rest of these examples of chronic diseases, we can see that a lot remains to be explained. And that still is one of the big challenges for all of public health. Do the science that will tell us what are the preventable risk factors for these kinds of diseases that we worry about. A lot of it, of course, is probably gene-environment interaction. Now, when we teach our courses in environmental epidemiology, we often start off by posing the question, what are the three biggest challenges in environmental epidemiology when it comes to methods? And it is, number one, exposure. Number two, exposure. Number three, exposure. Who in this room knows how much pesticides they're exposed to? If you took a blood test today, they'll tell you a little bit about recent exposures. If you paid the $500 to do the GCMS, to do the whole range of things, they'll give you something about some exposures. But the reality is it's very difficult to know. Much more difficult than just taking a smoking history and knowing how much individual has done. That also doesn't give you an idea of timing. And now we know that there are vulnerable stages of life during the life course. And who would know whether those pesticide exposures occurred when you were in utero or maybe in the first few years of life versus, when you were working in a farm in your teens? These are all questions that relate to dosimetrics and timing that are part of the challenge of environmental or occupational epi. So here's some examples from my own research. I've been doing research on lead exposure and toxicity for 25 years. You're all familiar with some of the sources of lead exposure, but I think it's important to remind ourselves that these are globalized exposures, in part because of the middle example here. And what you're looking at in this graph is samples of ice cores in northern Greenland and measuring the lead concentrations. And this is an area where there are no cars, there are no industries, there's hardly any people. And what you're looking at is stratospheric deposition of lead from pollution beginning in the 18th century down here. Let's see if I can get that arrow there. And this is where we put lead in gasoline. So the reality is that everybody in this room has lead levels in their body about three orders of magnitude greater than prehistoric man. And, of course, lead has no useful purpose in the body, so what's it doing to us? Well, part of our research group's question was, well, there's a lot of research now showing that lead makes kids stupid. That's particularly why we've worked very hard to get lead out of consumer products. We monitor children's blood levels. Pediatricians now have that as part of their core ethos, their understanding of environmental health threats. But, in fact, there's this whole big open question about cumulative exposure and what are the long-term effects, perhaps with a dose of latency, of that lead that we've been exposed to. And it turns out a lot of that lead actually doesn't go away. About 15% of whatever lead that you inhale or ingest gets socked away into bone. It substitutes for calcium in the hydroxyapatite structure of bone, and it sits there for many years. Okay? That actually provides us with a new approach for actually measuring cumulative exposure, another dimension of dosimetrics, if you will, in environmental epidemiology, which is that we developed this method down here in the bottom right-hand corner called KX-ray fluorescence, where we can actually measure how much lead is in your bones using a methodology that employs radiation physics and an approach very similar to bone densitometry, except that instead of just measuring the signal from calcium, we're measuring lead and calcium. And this is what the data looks like if you look at a population of middle-aged to elderly men, none of whom have had occupational exposure to lead, you know, like welding or working in a lead smelter. Their blood lead levels are all well below 10 micrograms per deciliter, basically in the normal range. But in any particular age, you see this very widespread in their bone lead levels, signifying that, yeah, they've had a lot of cumulative exposure to lead. So what is it doing? This is one of the early studies we published. We found that in this community-based sample of men, if you happen to be in the top quartile of bone lead, you will have doubled your risk of hypertension. Now, what was interesting about this study in particular, at least from my point of view, is that the effect of age in the final multivariate regression model was much less than that of bone lead. Why is that interesting? Well, as clinicians, we learned in medical school that, oh, when you get older, your blood pressure rises with age. It's not true. If you look at the Bantu in South Africa, when they're 20 and when they're 50, their blood pressure is pretty much the same. And then when you do the migration epidemiology studies, so you follow them as they go into cities, you'll see that then the blood pressure starts rising with age. So we've always known there's something about modern society that increases blood pressure. We didn't know if it was noise, nutrition, stress, or other things. But using new molecular markers and new techniques, we can actually try to disentangle these questions. Then when you follow those men for another 10 years, you can find that these bone lead levels are a major independent predictor of particularly cardiovascular mortality. It's an independent predictor of developing cataracts, probably because lead is a pro-oxidant stimulus on a place like the very sensitive epithelium tissue that makes up the lens of the eye. And then when you start marrying this with high-throughput genotyping and looking at genes that control enzymes that we know are important for lead metabolism, then you can actually start using a candidate gene approach to look at gene-environment interaction. And here what we're looking at is a graph of bone lead levels on the x-axis and performance on the mini mental status exam in adults. And basically what you're seeing is that if you have the wild type of for iron metabolism genes, nothing seems to happen as your bone lead levels go up, but there's a dramatic decline in your cognition if you happen to carry one of the HFE genes, these are the hemochromatosis genes. And probably because what the hemochromatosis gene does, even if you aren't homozygous for the C282 wild allele, which we actually give you hemochromatosis clinically, is that you have much more intracellular iron, and that will promote the Fenton reaction in conjunction with lead to increase the pro-oxidant damage that's going on in the brain, in your eye, and other places. It's basically accelerating the aging process throughout your entire body. Another aspect of this is looking at intergenerational issues. We found that lead actually gets mobilized very highly during pregnancy, crosses the placenta, and then affects fetal neurodevelopment. So even if you're a pediatrician and you're measuring blood levels when kids are young, you've missed part of the picture. It's what's happening during pregnancy. This is a graph showing maternal bone lead levels and the IQ of their offspring when they're two. Time's up. So that's now we're starting to get into the lead and Alzheimer's question. And we're getting into epigenetics as a way of trying to look at, using molecular epidemiology, to look at lead's impact on neurodegenerative disease. And that's all part of what could be thought of as exposomics and a new way of using molecular biology to understand exposures and applying them into these studies. The last thing I'll say is that we just heard this wonderful presentation on ISIS married to the Ontario Health Study, the Ontario version of a very large cohort study that produces new ways of bringing in environmental data into the big data enterprise, such as the geospatial data you get from looking at PM2.5 concentrations all over Toronto. This is generated by Greg Evans and his group at our school. We could merge all of that into big data city kinds of research, whether it's Montreal or it's Toronto or in other mega cities. And finally, we can work with our colleagues in environmental health who are doing climate science, doing infectious disease, to get at the truly global issues like global climate change, to get a better understanding of how this may affect our health here and also with our partners in more affected countries. And climate change is probably the biggest example of the spectacular inequities that we can see in environmental health these days because of climate change. And this wonderful density equalizing cartogram, is an example of that, showing you where the biggest climate-associated mortality is going to occur, even though the biggest carbon producers are probably right here in North America. So I think I'll end there and would love to entertain just a couple of questions.
Questions for Dr. Hugh?
If not, I will put you on the spot. I edit a book on toxicology every year, and the section that I feel most uncomfortable editing is the section on reproductive toxicity. Essentially, in the relation between genes and the environment, we see a field of that will be very confusing and very difficult. Even 10 years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency had its standard reproductive toxicity tests stating that you need the FO generation, the F1 generation, the F2 generation. But as biology advances, we know that if you're exposed to a chemical at a given moment, there is solid biological evidence that there will be consequences up to the 7th generation. So environmental factors and genetic factors will interact not only through the diversity of agents that we are exposed to, but as well with a very, very large time problem. So these two things connected together create a large data problem, don't they? Do you have comments?
Some of that research was done right here, of course, at McGill by Moshe Ziff and colleagues who are looking at behavior and epigenetic programming. This is a huge challenge to all of health research, is all understanding multi-generational effects. I was just down at NIH yesterday morning for Francis Collins' workshop on the Precision in Medicine Initiative. This is President Obama throwing $230 million into creating another big million-person adult cohort study in the U.S. But one of the most interesting questions was the ability to actually incorporate into it a multi-generational design, and not simply just waiting, you know, for people to have children, but also looking at families as part of the precision medicine initiative, and then incorporating an understanding of how these kinds of exposures and nutrition, et cetera, can have downstream effects that are totally unanticipated. I mean, the punchline is that Lamarck was right. Right? Actually, environment does affect kind of genetics, or maybe it's genetic programming, and we have to rethink the biological model as well as the prevention model. And it's it calls for incredible science. It's amazing things that the next generation will be able to do with this concept in mind as they apply both science experimentally, but also epidemiologically, but it's going to be a huge challenge. So it's kind of a quasi-answer.
Hi there. Thanks for a really wonderful talk. I'm Susan Stock. I'm an occupational medicine and public health preventive medicine specialist here at the Quebec Institute of Public Health, with appointments in this department and in social and preventive medicine at U of M. And I'm interested in your thoughts about the current health and the future of occupational medicine training and research in Canada and in the U.S.
Yeah, that's not a rosy story. I ran the occupational medicine residency at Harvard for 10 years. You know, the reality is that the Institute of Medicine has put out 3 reports in the last 20 years saying that we're really, really behind on training people who know anything about health and work. But the number of occupational physicians has not increased. In fact, it's gotten so bad that people without any occupational medicine training are being hired 3 times as fast as those people with MPHs to be corporate doctors, because no one feels that it's necessary to have that credential anymore. I mean, it's terrible. I think that in the U.S. at least, there's this divorce between understanding the public health needs and the workforce needs, and also how, we might develop a health sector response that's tailored to those needs. Occupational medicine is really still thought of as drug screening, pre-employment screening, and not much else. When you talk about sort of corporate influence on medicine, we usually think of drug companies, but that's nothing when it's compared to corporate influence in occupational medicine. So it's a huge challenge. As the dean of a public health school, it's nice to be in the driver's seat in being able to help maybe rethink this question in Canada. I'd love to carry this conversation through with you and our colleagues in Toronto and UBC and elsewhere, because I think there's an opportunity to rethink the entire model, particularly in this country, without it being colored by some of the terrible distractions and how that conversation gets shaped in the U.S. Perhaps there's some hope there.
A short conclusion. To solve big problems, you need all sorts of minds coming from all sorts of directions. Thank you very much.
Lunch is being served in the back, so thank you very much. And we're due back here at, 1:30. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very, very much.